Walk on by. Walk on by.
More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. The Milwaukee Brewers are on a pace to draw 3 million fans to Miller Park this year as they make another run to the playoffs. And soon, football stadiums around the NFL will be packed with fans. But turn back the clock to the 19th century, and the hottest ticket in town, as far as sports were concerned, was the sport of pedestrianism. Watching people walk around a track, often for days at a time. It's a sport that's almost entirely forgotten today, or at least it would be forgotten if not for a recent book by writer Matthew Algio. It's called Pedestrianism, When Watching People Walk Was America's Favorite Spectator Sport. In an interview recorded at Boswell Book Company this spring, Algio explained what spectator sports were like in this country before pedestrianism came along.
There really weren't spectator sports in the United States before the Civil War. The population of the country was pretty widely dispersed. It was a primarily agrarian culture. It wasn't until after the Civil War, you have the Second Industrial Revolution, people begin moving into the cities, mass migration into the cities, and accompanying this are the construction of the first large public buildings. And these are the things that made spectator sports possible in the decades after the Civil War. The problem is there really wasn't much to do in the United States in the way of entertainment in the 1870s and 1880s. Most of the entertainment at that time was still geared toward the wealthy. And so a ticket to a play or a musical might cost a dollar or two when the average worker was lucky to make a dollar a day. And pedestrianism, as boring as it sounds to us today, to watch, really filled a void in the United States, and especially in the 1870s, by giving people something to do.
What was the confluence of events besides the fact that the Second Industrial Revolution happened? People had extra spending money, but what happened to get people behind the idea of walking?
It really goes back to a guy named Edward Weston, and he was a door-to-door book salesman from Providence, Rhode Island. And in 1860, he made a bet with a friend on the outcome of the 1860 presidential election. Weston bet his friend that Lincoln would lose. Lincoln wins, of course. Weston loses the bet. And the terms of the bet were that the loser had to walk from Boston to Washington in 10 days and make it in time to see Lincoln's inauguration. And so Weston set out on February 21st, 1861, and began walking from Boston to Washington. And this really generated a lot of attention, a lot of excitement even in the country. People were really captivated by this, the idea that somebody would try to walk from Boston to Washington in 10 days in the middle of winter, terrible roads. Everybody had experience with walking long distances at that time. And so I think people really empathized with Weston. He arrived actually 4 hours late. He missed the inauguration. But he gained such fame from this walk that after the Civil War, he began staging walking exhibitions. He'd go to a town, and roller rinks actually were springing up everywhere. Roller skating was very popular at the time. So he'd get to town, and he'd rent out a roller rink, and he'd attempt to walk, say, 100 miles in 24 hours. And people would come by the thousands just to watch him walk in circles to see if he could cover this 100 miles in 24 hours. People paid about 10 cents to watch this. And especially in smaller towns, there was really not much else to do. And so Weston gained quite a lot of fame and also made a lot of money and also attracted a lot of competitors. People came up and said, well, I can walk 100 miles in 23 hours or 22. And eventually this kind of mutated or evolved into the six-day walking matches that really were the most popular form of the sport.
Well, so talk about what these events were like. Six-day walking matches were the most popular version of this. What would happen when you went to one of these things?
Well, first of all, you'd have usually the large arena in the city. In New York, it was Madison Square Garden. In Chicago, there was a building called the Expo, where the Art Institute stands now. But you would mark out a dirt track on the floor. It would usually be about a seventh or an eighth of a mile around. And the competitors would begin walking just after midnight, Sunday night, Monday morning. Of course, at that time, there were blue laws that prohibited any public amusements on the Sabbath. You couldn't do anything on Sunday.
This is why these are six-day matches.
Exactly. That's as long as they could be. And so they begin right after midnight, Sunday night, Monday morning, and then the competitors, the pedestrians, would go off. There were a team of judges that kept track of how many laps each competitor made, and they would continue walking as long as they could, as much as they could, right up until the following Saturday night at midnight. And whoever walked the farthest was the winner. I mean, the rules were pretty simple. But there were other things there, too. I mean, you had You know, there would be brass bands playing music. Celebrities would stop by. You might see Tom Thumb at one of the big walking matches in New York City. So people went not just to watch people walk, but also for the spectacle of the event. And I like to say, you know, football games can be pretty boring, but there's a lot to see at a football game besides the football. And so that was one of the attractions of the sport.
And presumably watching people walk at the beginning of a six-day race was significantly different than what the spectacle was like 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 days
right
into this.
Right. The hottest ticket was for day six, because not only was that when the outcome would be decided, but also when the competitors were most bedraggled, dehydrated, sleep deprived. They were just staggering around the track. I mean, I say it was like watching a NASCAR race in super slow motion. And part of the excitement of NASCAR is going to see the crashes. And this was the equivalent. This is when you would see the crashes would be on day 5 or 6. I mean, these guys would be so wiped out by then that it's really amazing that they were able to compete at all sometimes for 6 days.
This is almost the 19th century equivalent of an extreme sport.
Yeah, very extreme. They would be on the track, you know, upwards of 21 out of 24 hours a day. Usually they would sleep. They would usually have small cots, or they would even have small tents for them on the inside of the oval where they could sleep and also relieve themselves. But generally they'd be on the track about 21 hours a day, sleeping in, you know, 15 to 30 minute increments throughout the day. I go into the book in, I'm sure, excruciating detail about sleep patterns. But one of the things that these guys did is they slept by sleeping, you know, several times throughout the day. Most of us are monophasic sleepers. We just sleep once, and some are biphasic, where you sleep twice. Well, these guys, the best, I think, were polyphasic, where people can sleep several times throughout the day for 45 minutes or so. And this is what, you know, if you go, these guys who do a solo around the world boat races, they generally just sleep in small increments throughout the day.
Right. You're right. There's also like a subculture of pedestrianism where people would walk a mile every hour for as many consecutive hours as they could, and they would sleep basically from the moment they finished to the last
right
possible moment they could walk the next mile.
There was a guy in 1809, Captain Barclay was his name, a Scottish guy, and he walked 1 mile every hour for 1,000 consecutive hours to win a bet, which is, I think, 40-some days. And then, of course, somebody had to walk a half mile every half hour for 1,000 consecutive half hours. And then there was a woman, Ada Anderson, who took it to its ridiculous extreme by walking a quarter mile every 15 minutes for 1,015 minutes or whatever it was. So she got absolutely no sleep at all for 28 days. I mean, every 15 minutes she would walk a quarter mile. But that was one of the exhibitions that really attracted people's attention as well, these kinds of preposterous endurance events.
Well, and speaking of attention, this was a sport that was covered in the newspapers and magazines. What kind of reputation did pedestrianism have?
It had a mixed reputation, actually. The pedestrians were really the first celebrity athletes. They got endorsement deals. Some of them wore their sponsors on their shirt. So you're seeing the beginning of the corporate sports culture. They were really heroes, especially to a generation of young men and women who would imitate them. You hear about kids going out and imitating the walk of their favorite pedestrian the way somebody might imitate some, you know, their favorite
like
baseball
stance,
player's
right
batting stance, right? But as pedestrianism got more popular with the public, it also became more popular with gamblers, and it had the influence and the association with gambling, also with alcohol. They would sell so much alcohol at these events. And, of course, the temperance movement was very much alive at that time. And so the temperance movement kind of advocated against pedestrianism. They thought it was basically unholy. And so you see kind of a backlash. There's an anti-pedestrianism movement in the country, if you can believe that.
And if I remember correctly from the book, a couple of Wisconsin newspapers were kind of trumpeting the cause of anti-pedestrianism.
Yeah, and I don't know why, but I saw some of the most virulent anti-pedestrian editorials were in Wisconsin papers. I have no idea why this is. Maybe somebody here has – do you have something against walking in Wisconsin? I don't know what it is exactly. But, yeah, there were two Wisconsin papers that editorialized against pedestrianism. But they were really – just an example. There were papers everywhere that thought it was – and they also thought it was kind of ghoulish in a way. that you're, you know, by watching these people put themselves through these exertions and really pushing themselves to the, you know, brink of mental and physical collapse, that there was something, what's the word, exploitative?
Exploitative. Right.
Yeah, about it. And that was another reason that people campaigned against it.
One of the other things that struck me, though, as we think back recently, you know, we celebrated the anniversary of the integration of baseball, and that happened in 1947. Pedestrianism integrated 75 years before baseball.
Right. There were a number of famous black pedestrians. The most famous was a guy named Frank Hart. He was actually an immigrant from Haiti, moved to Boston, and on a lark entered a six-day race and won it, and so began entering more prestigious competitions and eventually won a couple very prestigious races. Pedestrianism really was a very democratic sport. I mean, if you were able to walk far in 6 days, you could compete on a level playing field, really. And so it opened doors for not only African Americans, but for Irish Americans and German Americans as well. It was a way to, much as sports are perceived this way today, it was a way to advance yourself, a way to make money, and a way to prove your worth.
Women did this too.
Yeah. Women pedestrians took part in six-day races. The women pedestrians had a major disadvantage, though, because the mores, would you say, of the time dictated that women covered, you know, you couldn't show your calves. So the women all had to race wearing full-length, often very, like, heavy velvet dresses and gowns. And so while the women competed and the races were very popular, they were at a decided disadvantage when it came to participating as opposed to the men who were able to wear tights and shorts.
So this booms fairly quickly, it seems, and the future seems very bright for pedestrianism. It ended almost as abruptly as it came up. What led to the end of pedestrianism, and why did the end come so quickly?
A couple of things. One, public confidence in the sport was really shaken by the association with gambling. There were gamblers that colluded with some of the lesser pedestrians to help fix races. There was also a doping scandal. One of the pedestrians was caught chewing coca leaves while he competed. And this also sort of hurt the perception, the public perception of pedestrianism. But the biggest thing that really killed pedestrianism in the end was the invention of the safety bicycle in 1885. An Englishman named Starley invented the bicycle. Before then, the bicycles were those kind that had the big front wheel and the tiny little back wheel, the penny farthing. And they were hard to race. They weren't very nimble. But the safety bicycle that Starley invented, which he named the Rover, incidentally, and then later made cars under that name, and the Land Rover and the Range Rover, kind of descendants of the safety bicycle. The safety bicycle was really nimble. It was quick. And you could race bicycles now easily. And, of course, watching a bicycle race, which also had held the promise of crashes, was much more exciting than watching the pedestrians walk around in circles for 6 days. So really, the six-day bicycle races kind of replaced the six-day walking matches almost overnight.
How hard was it to find information about the sport? How much evidence is still out there? I mean, for example, you look at the book and it only has drawings of walking matches.
Yeah, we don't have any photographs that I've been able to find, unfortunately. Most of my research came, there were several different sources. The best was contemporaneous newspaper reports. We talked about how there wasn't much else to do. Well, one thing there was that you could do was read newspapers, and there were lots of newspapers back then. I mean, I forget, New York City might have had 30 daily newspapers at the time. And so it was a very popular sport, and it was covered in the popular press, and so there are lots of newspaper accounts of it. And also, I was able to go back and find some old programs. New York Historical Society has some of the old programs from the races, and that had a lot of biographical information about different competitors. And a couple of the major competitors, Edward West and Daniel O'Leary, they were actually the subjects of biographies, and so there was a primary source material there as well.
You mentioned Madison Square Garden. That's obviously the Madison Square Garden that was first.
Right. That was the Madison Square Garden that was actually at Madison Square.
There are not any, to our knowledge, there are not any arenas still standing today that host a pedestrian match.
Actually, there is the Royal Agricultural Hall in London is the one place where it was built, I think, in the 1860s, and it was abandoned in the 1960s, but it was saved from demolition, and it's now a convention center. So I was able to go to the Royal Agricultural Hall, the Aggie. It's now the Business Design Center. And that's the one place where the great walking matches were held that is still in existence.
Let's talk about America's other favorite pastime. What was baseball going through at the time pedestrianism was coming and going?
The National League was founded in 1876, right at about the time that pedestrianism is becoming popular. The National League, though, in the early years was very disorganized affair. Teams came and went. Some teams, if they were losing and out of the pennant race at the end of the season, would just quit and not play the rest of the games. I think at least one team got kicked out of the National League the first year. But by the 1880s, the owners got together and decided, well, we really need to organize this thing. They did a couple of things. They imposed a salary cap of $2,500. And they also introduced the reserve clause, which was a notorious clause that bound a player to his team in perpetuity, basically. There was no, they ended free agency. And so this really stabilized baseball. But by 1890, there are 8 teams in the National League, and 7 of them are still around. Only the Cleveland Spiders are no longer with us. The other 7 teams in the National League still exist. The franchises have moved around, of course, a lot, but you can trace them right back to that time. And so by 1890, baseball had really become a viable enterprise, and a lot of the people who had watched the walking matches and the bicycle races had moved on to baseball as their favorite pastime.
Well, Matthew Algio, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Matthew Algio is author of Pedestrianism, When Watching People Walk Was America's Favorite Spectator Sport, published by Chicago Review Press. He spoke with us this spring in front of a live audience at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. That's the Labor Day edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for spending part of your holiday weekend with us, and I hope you'll be back here again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock. Fresh air is next.
These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you. Are you ready, Boots?